Merry Christmas, everyone. Welcome to the CPC Together podcast. Before we get started here, I just wanted to tell you, first of all, thank you for listening to this insane podcast. We had so much fun recording today's episode. But second, I just wanted to let you know that we have four Christmas Eve services at CPC this year. 9 and 11 are our typical services. In the morning, pretty simple. In the afternoon, 3:30 and 5, we will have two candlelight services. So I want to invite you to come to either one or both. It's going to be an awesome Christmas Eve together. Without further ado, here's today's insane episode. You're listening to CPC Together, a podcast produced by Central Peninsula Church in the San Francisco Bay Area, where we talk about pretty much everything. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. I have carefully recorded a list of secret sounds.
That was not one of them.
Yeah. And I'm going to play for you guys these sounds. And if any of you get any of them right, I'll be surprised. But
like sound effects?
No, you'll understand it in a second. So if any of you, whoever wins this game, is going to get
$100.
Any item on the menu.
Oh, good at chow.
At McDonald's.
Oh. The McRib.
Rachel's the only one excited about that.
Oh, I am.
I haven't been to McDonald's in years.
Okay. Not
I've still
McDonald's.
Never been.
Any item on the
menu.
That's
right. You've never been.
Nico.
Brandon has vowed to change that.
I secretly want
gone.
Nico to win, so he has to pick something off.
Are you opposed to going?
At this point,
like,
I feel like you have to be.
I don't have any moral or ethical quandaries with it. It's just,
if you've made it this far,
it's mostly disinterest.
You should see about going the distance without ever going.
Yeah, you imagine being an 80-year-old being able to say, "I never ate McDonald's."
I feel, but that's not super special.
Imagine what that could be.
Imagine what that a moment gift. Of grandeur. Yeah. You'd be probably on some news channel. Yeah. This man never ate McDonald's.
By then, we might be living to like 220. 220-year-old never ate at McDonald's.
But appropriately, since we are talking about McDonald's, this is going to be called "What is Brandon eating?"
Oh, no.
All right. Oh man. So we have to guess not the sound, but what you're eating.
Yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
We are going to lose all 12 of our listeners when we start playing. My wife being one of them. She's never listened, I don't think, ever. But she certainly won't on this one.
Well, this is good ASMR. What? You haven't even heard anything yet.
I'm thinking of your tongue slapping around. I'm hearing the wetness of each chew.
So I'm going to tell you guys. So you have to... Oh, that's great. So you have to... In order to accurately guess, you have to take all of it into account. The wetness of it. You have to
sloppiness.
Think about how long is it taking me to chew?
Oh.
This feels like a messed up baby shower game.
How long have you been collecting these recordings?
Well, I just did these this morning.
Oh. Okay.
So you had five different things this morning?
Yeah.
So we've got breakfast category narrowed down.
Probably.
Unless he was like slamming chili and moving over to Captain Crunch and like eating a hot dog. Like, you just had the weirdest.
That one would sound good.
Chili and Captain Crunch. Oh man, we have to make someone do that at some point if they lose a bet. Wow. Top your chili with Captain Crunch.
Man. All right, let's get this over with.
Yep.
Oh.
Brandon sounds.
Hit it one more time. One more time. That's a potato chip. That's some sort of chip.
See, the first part tells me there's texture, but the second part, I don't know what's happening.
My thought was an apple, like a slice of apple.
I went apple, but the later bites moved me from apple. Yeah. It wasn't that they had that crisp at the, beginning.
So Kevin's apple, Nico is apple, Rachel
cereal.
Okay, the answer
hear the slurp.
The answer is grape.
Oh, okay. That's what I'm picking up is not apple. Was the grape the secondary?
I think Rachel got liquid. Rachel could tell that it was liquid.
We got fruit.
Yeah.
That's like a Cheeto.
Pirate's candy.
Yeah. Like a puff.
Yeah.
You're still chewing.
Ugh. And licking his lips.
Still going.
One more
I'm
going to
go celery because I don't think you have full carrots in your house. Because that's weird. Baby carrots would be the way to go. Yeah.
Okay, you guys ready for the answer?
Ugh.
This is Rachel's personal favorite. This is steak.
What?
It's a piece of steak.
How the heck do you eat steak, dude?
It's a piece of steak.
That's way. You either cooked it wrong or you're eating it wrong.
The sound that Rachel made in response to that was a mix of horror, pain, fear, disgust, dismay.
Okay, here's three. Here's three.
That's a carrot.
That's celery.
No, I don't think he eats carrots or celery.
I think
one more time. This one
or
does
it's
feel
dry.
Like it's dry. It feels dry. That's a chip. That's some sort of chip.
Oh. No, you might be right, Kevin.
Yeah, that's some that's some sort of chip.
Jesus?
No, I don't think it's a cracker. I think it falls apart too easily.
Triscuit.
It was actually Triscuit.
What?
Oh!
Triscuit?
Wow.
Yeah, but it was these weird little thin Triscuits.
Triscuits are gross.
Well done, yeah. Nico.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. Nico's going to Mickey D's, man.
Sound four.
Two more.
Oh.
Thank you for not swallowing it. I was catching that, by the way. I'm going to need that again.
So different
that's like
texture.
That's an apple.
Different texture than
That sounds like a puff of some sort. That sounds like Pirate's Booty.
A real puffy. Popcorn. Yeah, which is kind of in the Pirate's Booty realm.
Popcorn?
Yeah, it feels like a handful
Popcorn's
of popcorn.
A good guess.
Like you're like, you're like getting the whole thing in there.
All right, so Nico was almost there when he said puffy. It was those meringue cookies.
Oh.
You know,
we're introducing some sweets.
The little meringue. Okay. Yeah, the meringue puffs.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Okay, last one.
It's a weird meal you're having this far.
This is what he does for us for the podcast.
So gross. Oh, I'm gonna try it again.
Nico's face.
Oh, right there. What is happening? I can't even bring myself to listen all the way through. I'm gonna need
it. Dude, is that yogurt?
I was just gonna guess
something
yogurt.
Sloppy. Hit it again. Oh. Hit it one more time. Hang on.
Oh.
It's like yogurt with granola because there is a crunch though.
Is that a parfait?
This is even
yogurt?
Better than I thought it was gonna be.
Or rice pudding?
Yeah, and what are you doing chewing your yogurt, man? There's got to be, like some
rice.
Granola.
Rice pudding.
Tapioca.
Yeah. Dude,
I can hear your tongue slapping around on that thing.
Okay, Rachel, your last chance. I know how much you love McDonald's. Do you guys know that Rachel actually has the McDonald's app?
I do.
Oh,
it saves me money. I get a free hot fudge sundae on Friday. Based on your reaction of rice pudding, I don't think it's it. So I think I would say yogurt.
All right, the answer is banana.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Oh. I should have known you'd throw a banana because that's like the worst thing to chew.
Thank you guys for playing that game. As I said,
I don't want to thank you.
Yeah, that was terrible.
I figured you would love it and hate it. I didn't realize how much you would hate it.
That might be the most uncomfortable I've been in a long time. I think that hits it.
It's different.
Oh.
So Advent, huh?
Chewing on the word of God, am I right? Listen, that.
What does Advent actually mean? Oh. We use Advent in our language, that not referring to the Christmas season.
Oh, do we?
Right?
Do you normally use the word Advent?
Yeah, it's the advent of something. Wouldn't we?
I mean, you certainly could. I just don't think I've ever heard it normally used. That is a good use of it.
That use is out of style, but it's valid. In my house, Advent meant we get a calendar.
Yeah.
And every third day, there were three of us, so we'd rotate through who gets to open up the calendar and take out the chocolate.
Yeah. Yeah, the joke I've told many in Advent in a row now, which is why I didn't use it this year, is when we were growing up, we had a big Advent calendar. We didn't get candy or anything, though. It was like a felt board, you know, like flannel graph. And so my mom had made this thing where there were like 24 stones that Mary, Joseph, and the donkey would move towards Bethlehem. Oh. And so I'm convinced she made it before I, as the youngest, was around. And so my brother was Joseph, my sister was Mary, and every morning they'd move it over. And then I think what happened was I came along, and who did I get to be? I got to be the donkey.
You're the donkey, so, that's right.
So I got to be the donkey moving us along the path. But yeah, it gets to that idea, you know, the Advent calendar, which is probably people's most familiar expression of Advent, is pointing towards what Advent means. It's about waiting. It literally means the coming, Adventus, or arrival. And it's about that anticipation of God. And so there's... In kind of church vernacular, there's three arrivals that we celebrate in Advent. We look back at the reality that Jesus 2,000 years ago has come. So that's, again, the Christmas story. So in Advent now, we reflect on that. Jesus has come. The second Advent is that he will come in the future. So we then look forward in the Advent season to his second coming. And that is, again, the kind of the celebration that Jesus will come. So Jesus has come. Jesus will come. And the third Advent or arrival that we celebrate is the arrival of his daily presence with us. So Jesus has come, Jesus will come, and then Jesus is here. He is arriving in our daily expression of Advent. And so that's really at the heartbeat of Advent, as we step into the story of God yet again, the story of Jesus yet again, with an eye backwards, an eye forwards, and an eye to the present of what is happening in that. So it's preparing us for the mystery of God incarnate, of God becoming human, becoming flesh, if you will.
And so Advent, there's a lot of sitting in detention, and there's a waiting, there's an anticipation, like you said.
Yeah, yeah.
You had a really good Rich Velotis quote. I'm wondering if you could read that
again. Yeah, I think he tweeted this out a little while ago, or X'd it out. I don't know what it's called now, but he sent it out on the interwebs. And he talks about how the good news of Advent, so it's in this waiting, the good news is not that we faithfully wait, because we often don't, but it's that God is faithful in his coming. And that's a good posture, I think, when we encounter Advent, is it really is that posture of not walking through Advent faithfully. Like, if, I don't know, do you guys have any Advent... Like practices, if you will, that you guys do regularly? Like, I've tried year over year to like do a family devotional every night or something, like those sorts of things. And I like fail miserably every year at trying to like uphold a regular type of Advent thing. And it, to me, it's a reminder of this quote of like, gosh, even in trying to reflect on something like Advent, like I can be so unfaithful to that.
Yeah.
But again, that's in some ways, that's the spirit, is Advent is about reminding us God is faithful in his coming, not in our anticipating. So there's a gift to that.
We might've tried to do something once, but it's actually kind of shocking to look back on all the years and realize that we never gave Advent much of a second thought.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Aside from, again, the chocolate calendar that would just keep the kids engaged while the parents do Christmas shopping and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah.
There was never really a kind of a daily focus.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's wrapped up in a larger, you know, this idea of the liturgical calendar, the church calendar. It's wrapped up in this thing that honestly, that the Protestant Reformation is probably where it started to drift away, but we lost the practice of something like a liturgical calendar. Catholics still practice this pretty regularly. Another kind of Anglican streams and other streams of the Protestant church do as well. But Advent is the beginning of the church calendar. And what the church calendar does when you begin to observe it and kind of walk through it year over year is it retells the story of Jesus' life over and over, but in a way that isn't lecture. It's an embodied way, right? So like Advent is, you know, this is the reason that I, you know, I've tried even this year to tame myself from saying Merry Christmas, but to say Happy Advent, because Advent is essentially like the moments before Jesus' actual birth. And so Christmas is coming, and we have a 12-day celebration festival in the church calendar, what's called Christmastide, where we actually celebrate the birth of Jesus. But technically, this is not Christmas time. This is Advent season, which then will give way to Christmastide. And so if you imagine, again, walking through something like a church calendar, year over year, you're embodying the story of Jesus, which gets at us in a different way. Right? So Advent gives way to Christmastide, which eventually kind of moves towards Lent, towards Easter, and kind of in those high moments of the church calendar, we're quite literally with festivals and reflections and practices, we're living into this very story of Jesus year over year. And that has a formative effect to us, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe the best example of this, well, maybe two examples. One is like with the new year, like according to our Gregorian calendar of like January 1st coming. I mean, I would imagine most of us naturally start thinking, yeah, what do I want to accomplish in the new year? What are the changes I want? I want to lose weight this year, right? Kind of the classic change. That's been formed into us. There's nothing new about January 1st that's different than December 31st. Mm. It's just another 24-hour cycle. But in our minds, because we have this concept of a new year, we kind of have been formed to think a fresh start. There's nothing technically fresh or different about that particular day, but that's formed in us. So the church calendar uses a little bit of the same logic of what if we could get at a kind of guttural reaction, like as I step into Advent, oh man, the candles are coming out, the lights are turning on, the tree's going up. Like all of that can actually shift your spirit to prepare for something without us really knowing it, you know, in the same way that Lent prepares for Easter and all that sort of thing. So the other example that might be better is I've used this with Brandon before. My family's a big baseball family, so we're huge fans of baseball. And so around April and all that, when spring training begins to take off, me and my brother relationally, we start to connect more with my dad, my brother, and I. We start texting each other all sorts of, hey, what, you know, what's the lineup looking like? How's the rotation looking like?
Talking about the Dodgers.
Ugh. Hating on the, yeah. But all that kind of stuff is like there's a sort of gut reaction that because that's a regular rhythm, that our relational rhythms actually are tied to something like the calendar. So the same could be true of the liturgical calendar, the church calendar.
It's astonishing how much the Gregorian calendar and the prospect of a new year is ingrained in us.
Yeah.
My first thought when you said that, my first two thoughts actually, one was, man, that's so true. There is no fundamental difference on any level other than this, like not even subconscious, than the, this is what's on paper.
Yeah. There's a lot of astrologists collectively agreed with crystals that would disagree with both of you.
Yeah, I'm sure. But my second thought was, wow, thanks for ruining the prospect of New Year.
Yeah. There is nothing fresh ever.
And he was like,
why even try now?
Yeah.
He's phoned it in.
But now it's like, well, okay, but that means there's no reason to wait until the New Year, and there's no reason to anticipate it in that sense.
Yeah. Which is interesting, because again, like the Gregorian calendar is just one day after another. But like the church calendar, again, is telling a story, which means there's a different kind of progression, right? Like there is, in fact, a development opposed to just now it's spring.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, we do live in an area where climate, you know, is pretty moderate year round. Uh-huh. Like I am thinking of, you know, some that are from like the Midwest or whatnot, or my family now out in Georgia, where there is a sense of which like the different seasons have a darkness to them. So like there is some progression to, man, I'm waiting for spring because the ground is frozen for like 4 months or, you know, like that. Yep. So that might have a little bit of a different appeal, but anyway.
You talked about this Bonhoeffer letter, and it had that quote have some depth.
Yeah.
It was a letter that he wrote to his fiance.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like this whole thing, Bonhoeffer himself is just a fascinating guy, but he was going to be killed because he was plotting an assassination for Hitler.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so on his, you know, close to his death, he writes this letter to his fiance.
Yeah, yeah. Which, again, the reason I bring that up is because what Advent does to us this season is it invites us to look at the darkness, to look at the shadows. Whereas if you rush straight to Christmas, which has its season to be celebrated, you rush towards the light. Right. And so, like, the example I gave was Maddie a few years ago came up just distraught of, like, how can we celebrate Christmas? The world's falling apart. It's all sorts of darkness. And the reason that we kind of have that response often of that is we don't, without properly practicing Advent, we rush straight to all the joy, but it becomes, again, a veneer to what's actually happening in the world. It's like, yeah, we just numb the pain for a month or two, and then we go to Christmas without ever dealing with that underlying kind of hurt. And so Christmas can become real, like, flimsy, right? It's just, yeah, it's a cheap little alternative to the reality of life, and let's escape for a month or two into 1,000 Hallmark movies or whatever, but never deal with that underlying pain. And so the reason I brought Bonhoeffer in was, you know, here's someone who's in a pretty dark, or could be considered an incredibly dark moment, right? He's under Nazi oppression. He's at this point in his life, a year and a half from being executed by the Nazis. He's in prison. Like, the shadows are heavy. The darkness is heavy. And yet he writes this quote, he says, "We shall ponder the incomprehensibility of our lot," meaning can't fathom the situation we're in, right? The incomprehensibility of our lot, "and be assailed by the question of why," which again is a very human question. Why is it dark? Why are we stuck here? "Over and above the darkness already enshrouding humanity, we should be subjected to the bitter anguish of a separation whose purpose we fail to understand." So there he's just saying, I long to be with you. You're my fiance, but yet we're separated and we can't understand why, because this, you know, this massive global tragedy is playing out. And then just when everything is bearing down on us to such an extent that we can scarcely withstand it, the Christmas message comes to tell us that all our ideas are wrong, and that what we take to be evil and dark is really good and light because it comes from God. Our eyes are at fault, that is all. God is in the manger, wealth in poverty, light in darkness, secure in abandonment. No evil can befall us. Whatever men may do to us, they cannot but serve God, who is secretly revealed as love and rules the world and our lives. So he's getting at this concept of, like, God in the manger, wealth and poverty. Is from the external, it looks dire, right? A baby born in a manger is not the plan, right? They were looking for a place and an end, something with more security. Darkness looks like it's evil. But he says, though, like, the Christmas story reminds us that what we see from that kind of external perspective, God is doing something different in the midst of that. God is in the manger, not just some vulnerable couple that's on the run for their lives from a political leader. Like, God is in there. God is in the manger, light and darkness, all that kind of stuff, wealth and poverty. And that's the Christmas story. So it's like Advent reminds us, again, in the midst of that, not to place the veneer over the darkness, but to enter into it and say, God is working in this space. God is in the midst of that. Thicken is the word I think of it. Like, it thickens the Christmas story to think, gosh, there's more here than just the lights and the glitz and all that.
What did he say? Our eyes are at fault.
Yeah.
That is a beautiful.
Isn't that good?
Beautiful quote.
Because it's so hard to see beyond when you're in the thick of those circumstances. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to see beyond them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think this is some of the struggle with, like, when you look at a nativity scene. Right? Like, we domesticate them and they look so quiet. Like, even honestly, like the song Silent Night, I have a feeling that night when Jesus was born, I've been in a delivery room. It wasn't a silent place. Like, we take the sort of edge off this story by domesticating it, putting it in a cute, like animals in a farm scene don't tend to just sit there quietly and peacefully, particularly when they're screaming and someone's giving birth. And, like, you know what I mean? Like, there is a sense where we have flattened that story,
or somehow they're all wearing white robes,
my
nativity scene that I have at home.
Yeah, exactly. And again, this isn't to, like, and you know, a couple months ago, I think I made everyone feel bad for wearing a cross as jewelry, so I don't want to make everyone feel bad for having a nativity scene, but I want us just to remember kind of the edge to it. Remember that there was more going on. I mean, again, Mary and Joseph were on the run for their life. Mm. They didn't have a place to stay, which seems so benign, but it's like they're homeless. They didn't know what was going to happen next. To travel the 100 miles or so they did, it's a long, arduous journey for someone 9 months pregnant. Like, I mean, even like I think about this sometimes too. Like I think of Mary was pregnant for 9 months. Like that's a hard journey in the first century to just carry a child. Like there's so much more to that moment than just what we tend to wake up thinking, oh yeah, Jesus was born today. Mm-hmm. You know, like it was hard. It was dark. Our eyes are at fault. We miss kind of that sort of edge. And it's a story I think we need, you know, because the first Christmas was dark and our world is often that way. You know, I mean, we experience those sorts of shadows.
I say, I think I had always seen the manger. I don't know if cute is the right word.
Yeah.
But I think a lot more like clean.
Yeah.
And maybe more, I don't know, fitting. Holy. Holy. Yeah. Or like it fits the Christmas book that you would read to your kids, yeah, kind of thing. But sitting in high school this Sunday, Sam was teaching about it and he said, it's not a sanitized, cleansed, or washed version. But it's perfectly orchestrated so that our God shows up in the mess.
Yeah.
Like good. It's intentionally messy.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was nothing like clean or cute about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But God was present in the midst of brokenness.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good.
So this whole message was kind of couched in the theme of peace,
mm-hmm,
being the undoing of strife. And you kind of talked about two different forms of strife, external and internal. And I'm wondering if you could help us unpack that a bit.
Yeah. So external strife, you know, that's the things I think that probably first come to mind. It's the things that are not internal to us. So they're broken relationships. There's, you know, wars going on around the world. Like that's a darkness, a strife that's carrying out. It's the kind of school shootings, the pandemics, racism, you know, like hostility, broken families, you know, diagnoses, like all those things that in some ways we encounter by living in a world that's essentially has the entanglement of sin, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a sense in which that we all feel that for sure. It's again, what the example I gave with Maddie, that's what she was sensing. Man, there's so much external strife. How could we possibly celebrate Christmas?
Mm.
I think this is the moment that sort of external strife, when you ask those questions of like, Lord, take this away, this circumstance, remove it, take it out of my experience, resolve this, you know, those sorts of questions, the why questions, all that. And then internal strife, is often, not always, but often the way we deal actually with external strife. This is addictions. This is depression. This is grief. This is, you know, those things that some are, you know, something like grief is a positive way to deal with external strife. That's a healthy thing. Not easy, but healthy. Addictions, depression, those sorts of things tend to be on the other end, like particularly around addictions. That's a coping mechanism to deal with external strife. But they entrap us. And so the internal things are a little more of the things we do to ourselves. And again, some of those can be healthy. Again, grief, healthy. Addiction, not so much. So like,
But even as a response, grief can be unhealthy if it's mishandled.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or even like, I think my point is even just more so like, Advent's still about that. Like it's still about like, grief is just not fun. Like no one wants to grieve. And so in that grief, Advent still has something to say to that internal strife. But yeah, so that, I mean, this concept, this theme of peace is about stepping into that external and internal strife and working or undoing, as we've been using that word this series, undoing that, bringing reconciliation to all of that. That's what, again, Advent is trying to enter into and do.
It's cool to hear that, because I've been noticing that more and more, even in secular, like psychological literature, the idea that external factors influence internal responses that can be extremely negative.
Mm-hmm.
And the more worldly response, which also conveniently ties into our church's recommended response, is a form of meditation, silence and solitude.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let yourself sit in that, identify it, and then hand it off to God.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is way easier said than done.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The semester for this past year just ended, and
Previously in the school year, I had built up the habit of running 3 times a week. Finals and preparations for Christmas came around, and all of a sudden my stress levels shot up, and I noticed one of the first things to be completely abandoned was the practice of running in favor of much more self-destructive habits like staying up super late watching YouTube and wasting my time in all sorts of other ways.
Yeah.
It was interesting that I could identify the external strife that drove the internal strife.
But then
it was like this vicious cycle. And so I found myself just hoping that when the external strife is gone and school is over, I can dispel the internal strife.
Yeah, I was thinking of that old quote, you may or may not have heard, but the idea that the only way out is through, right? Like when you're in...
There's a country song about that.
I feel like there's every country song about that.
It's deep.
But that sense of like when you're in pain or experiencing that strife, we often want to sidestep it. Like we think the only way out is around or something, or to mask it or to just stuff it away. But the only way out of the pain is through the pain. Like you have to journey through it. That's part of the healing process, like moving towards whatever that pain, that unsettledness is. And then again, where I obviously the main point of the sermon was that Jesus is our peace. Like what we need is not the absence of that circumstance or strife. You need Jesus walking with you in the midst of it. Cause that's the way out, is through it. But again, the difference between like a self-help gospel or, and the Christian gospel is we have someone who has gone through it and is leading us through it, opposed to we're on our own, stuck by ourselves to figure it out.
I love how you positioned it. Like when we are experiencing that strife, instead of leaning into it, like you're talking about, we develop different ways to do it. And you kind of talked about these different responses that we have to distress. And one of the things that really jumped out at me, first that we seek to control things.
Yeah.
And I thought about, I don't know if you brought this up in a sermon or I heard this before, but it said a lot of people are watching, like my wife, she watches at night, she watches, The Office. She rotates between The Office, Parks and Rec, and I forget Friends. What the third Friends.
Yeah.
And
that's a decent rotation of shows though.
And there's Kevin, I don't know if you said this or not, but someone said a lot of people are doing that because it's predictable.
Yeah.
You know, the characters, you kind of know what's going to happen. And there's something in that, that helps that control side of you sort of like ease up at night. Which is so funny because I always give her such a hard time like that. She's like, these are actually my friends, Brandon.
Yeah.
But the other thing that you
Didn't say that, but that's spot on. Like there is something to that predictability that our heart. And it's, going back to your point on your sermon a couple weeks ago around the Hallmark movies and them all being identical. Like there's probably something to that too. Like it's like putting on a nice blanket.
I just want to know exactly what's going to happen. Yeah. These two are eventually going to end up together. I'm going to watch it unfold.
He's going to move to the small town. They're not going to go back to the big city.
This is the time of year. My only de-stressor is watching a shockingly handsome guy from a big city come to his small town where there's a shockingly beautiful woman that they inevitably...
Yeah. But the other thing you said was in our responses to distress is that we turn to worthless things. We fall for delusions or lies. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah. So this was directly out of David's words in Psalm 4, where it says, how long will my people turn my glory into shame? And he says, how long will you love delusions and seek false gods? And, he's again in this moment of crisis. This is in many ways a sort of lament type psalm. And he's just reflecting on, gosh, the two things they seem to be turning to. Delusions, which I had not known that word can be translated worthless, which I thought was really interesting. That's what essentially a very valid translation of this verse could be. How long will you love worthlessness, right? Like worthless things.
Kind of makes sense.
It kind of does, right? Like when you think of like a delusion really isn't worth anything. And then he goes on to the false gods. We'll get to that. But like this idea of delusions is really where I got back to this concept of control of, I think the reason we buy lies is because it doesn't match reality, but it makes sense in our head, right? Like when you're asking the question of why God did this happen? Why did I receive this diagnosis? Why did I lose my job? Why? All those sorts of things. You're searching to try to make sense of it. But at times, it's just the result of chaos. Like there's a sense in which sin has released chaos into the world.
And so there is just, in fact, brokenness. And that often is our experience in the world. Like, I'm not one to believe that God is orchestrating all of those sorts of brokenness. I just believe that there's God, you know, the text in Romans we turn to there is that God will use all things for the good, but I don't believe God causes all those things. I think there's just a result of chaos.
Yeah.
And often we want to make sense of it. And so we say things that I think are flimsy and non-biblical, like, but I'm trusting that everything has a purpose and God's using, like, God is using it, but God didn't cause it. Like, there's a plan for everything. Kind of is the way I'd respond to that.
Kind of creates purpose out of it.
Yeah. It's in some ways, again, it's a delusion. It's trying to control it, because then if it's the posture of, okay, God caused this for some reason, which again, I don't believe he always does. Then I can control. Okay. Then I hold, okay, something will come on the other side of this. The hard part is, part of that is accurate. God will use those things for the good. I believe that. That's one of the most stunning things about God, is that he takes all these broken pieces and in fact does bring something good. But the delusion can also go the other direction, where the diagnosis comes, the loss of a loved one, and you're saying, why God? And the other delusion you can believe is, God hates me. That's another way to reconcile in your head, this is why it happened, because God hates me. But that's, again, it's a delusion. It's what we see from Scripture, what you understand of the character of God, what you've seen over time is that that is not who God is. God is not, in fact, hate. He is love. But we can buy that delusion because, again, it reconciles it in our mind. In some way, it brings your mind to a sort of stasis, because now it's this thing that doesn't make sense. I can make sense of it, even if it's a lie. And so it can play out in those big ways. It can play out in other smaller ways. The delusion that buying that particular car will satisfy my deepest ache, or, you know, if that relationship works out, I'll just keep, you know, chasing that thing, that pleasure, whatever, that will satisfy your deeper longing. And I like that word delusion, because it clues us into how it distorts something that is, in fact, maybe good, and making it more than it is. And this goes back to even the Renewing the Mind series. We talked through the idea that, like, something like pleasure isn't an inherently wrong thing. We can go that route, but it can be twisted by the devil to make us believe that it's an ultimate thing, when those things are penultimate. So enjoying a good meal is a good, healthy thing that can, in fact, bring pleasure and is a good thing. If you believe that that's where you're going to find, like, your satisfaction fully satiated, that's where it becomes a problem. And so that's where it's, you know, a little bit of that ordering of the loves we've talked about. Mm. It's not that lesser loves are bad. They just need to be properly ordered. And delusions give us this sense of control, but they're ultimately around worthless things, things that are not ultimate, and we make them ultimate, which for a moment stabilizes us, but it actually reaps far more havoc down the road. And then he goes on and says this idea of false gods. And I kind of brought that into, it's very similar to the delusion idea, but it's that there's these false gospels, these false messages of what will in fact satisfy. And these can be classically, again, things like success, status, you know, pleasure, whatever it is, all those money, security, all those things are sort of false gods that we believe will take the place of God. Because again, if eternity has been placed in the heart of mankind, of humankind, we're meant to be satisfied solely in God. And so anything that promises to deliver what God can is and can't is a false god. Hmm. And so to me, there are two ways in which we control a lack of peace, a sense of brokenness, is we buy into delusions and we buy the false gospels that these gods offer. And again, the trickiest part is they feel good. It feels like it actually is bringing reconciliation, but ultimately it's hollow and worthless.
Ties back to the gods of accomplishment and accumulation.
Yeah, yeah. Big time. Big time. Especially this time of year. Mm-hmm. We buy into that myth a lot.
What's a podcast safe delusion that you buy into sometimes?
Oh, man. It's like 1,000 of those. Hang on. Yeah, there's a bunch of those. I mean, I think of one. Like, I think of the way that I can approach, you know, my parenting. Like, I think of the, you know, when parenting's so funny. Like, I remember when I found out we were pregnant with Maddie, like, I instantly had all sorts of ideas around what my child would be like, right? And so you have these visions, these hopes for like what you think your child would look like, and more often than not, they're just projections of your own broken ego. Yeah. It's like all the things that you didn't turn out in your life, you just project onto your child and crush them. But there's a delusion that if my child lived up to that picture, that image, well then, yeah, I'll succeed or I'll thrive, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think there can be one of the, you know, that's a delusion, I think, that I can buy into often is that. But what's so disheartening about that is if I hold to that sort of delusion, I can never love my child for who that child is, because I'm always trying to love a projection of something. And it's just horrifying because it not only crushes them, but I miss the incredible beauty of who that child is. And so like, there's a sense in which that sort of delusion, is just, it's heartbreaking because it's crushes everything around you, your own sense of worth. It crushes your child, others. And you can map that onto a spouse, a roommate, a friend. I mean, same sort of thing, right? If you have a vision of what your spouse should be, you're not actually loving your spouse. You're loving some vision of them. And then it's, I don't know who you are anymore.
Yeah.
Well, you never did, because you had this other image of them and you didn't actually come to a place of loving them.
I think that's so, I love that analogy, because I think we haven't really touched on the fact that when you are following a delusion, you're missing out on the real.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's really like, we're really actually kind of hurting ourselves.
Yeah.
In the reality with all of that.
And Jesus deals in the real. Like, it sounds strange to think through, but like, that's ultimately what discipleship is doing, is it's confronting us with the most ruthless reality and trying to then have us sit in that. And most of us can't, myself included, which is why I sin, which is why I go to these false gods and delusions, not always because I'm just shaking my fist at God. Sin does have that element where it is like a sort of rebellious thing, but sin also has this element of simply, I can't take the reality of my life. And so now I have to do something to satisfy it, right? Mm-hmm. Like someone caught in a sort of chemical dependency cannot sit with the reality. And so they're doing something to cope. And that's that sort of, you don't ever get to then enjoy reality. Mm-hmm. And maybe the hardest thing for us in 2023, almost 24, is that we have so many coping mechanisms at our disposal. And again, to me, the quickest one is something like an endless, you know, social media stream in which you can fill your consciousness. It'll think for you. You don't ever have to just sit and look at the real reality of your life, because you're just there. And that's
because you're looking at the real, R-E-E-L.
Hey.
You know what I'm saying?
Real over reels, am I right?
Yeah, that's a country song.
In the works.
And that's really
find
where
the real. Find the real.
And that's where David goes in the psalm too, you know, when he says in verse 4, tremble and do not sin, which is that idea of like, feel the effects of whatever that is, that strife that you're having, that's there. But then his encouragement is, don't sin though because of that. So don't turn to those delusions or false gods. And he says, when you're on your bed, search your hearts and be silent. And, you know, this goes back to when we were talking in the Silence of Solitude series, that I think one of the reasons that I struggle with sitting quietly before God and before myself is I have to deal with the real. Like when I'm quietly at home in my home office, sitting there trying my practice of 10 minutes in quiet, like I want to be distracted because I don't often want to look at my own failures or look at life and the way it turned out. That's a different image than I thought I would have, like all that sort of thing. But that's David's kind of prescription, if you will, is search your heart and be silent, like sit with the real and bring yourself before God.
I think it's appropriate to end with a Kevin Snead quote from your sermon.
Oh.
Peace is not the absence of conflict, but the presence of Jesus. Mm. And I think that's really, really important, because sometimes we think that being present with Jesus means our conflict goes away.
Yeah.
And we really don't see that in the biblical story. Yeah. We don't see that at Christmas time. If anything, sometimes we see the opposite of that, but God allows us to see the bigger story behind what's going to happen with our circumstances.